Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm airing an interview I did a while back with the remarkable Mike Markovarich. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive, finding wisdom's other words. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being the person you really are. Not the person that you think you should be. Not the person that someone told you you should be. Not the person other people are. Not the person you think you need to be in order to get somebody's attention, affection, interest. Just the person you really are. And as a therapist, it's clear to me that many, 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 many of us are keeping quite a bit, which is true about us, undercover. In my show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. The remarkable Mike Markovarich is a pianist. And if you've seen or heard him play, you know what I'm talking about. Maybe you don't know the story of how he became this person who he really is. So I'm going to start off with a cut from his CD, Solid. Then I'm going to play my interview with Mike, and then I'm going to play a little bit of another cut from the CD to go out on. So here is Mike Markovarich and his trio.
Thank you.
here with Mike Markovarich. Did I say that right?
Yeah, you did pretty well. It's
Markovarich.
You got it.
Imagine people struggle with it.
You name it, I get it.
I'll bet you.
Every pronunciation you can imagine. And mispronunciation.
Oh, I'm quite,
they do their best, but it's they don't always get it.
You're a kind man, Mike.
Well, it pays. It's worth it to be kind.
I believe it. Yeah. I believe it, although you wouldn't know that by some people's behavior.
Well, let's not go. I don't want to. Oh, boy.
So I'm here in Mike's office, which is outside of his studio, which is in his house. And Mike is a master pianist. I've seen Mike turn a room full of uninterested people into people who are screaming and jumping up and down and asking for more and more and more and more. He's not only a brilliant pianist, he's a remarkable entertainer. And I'm doing this series called Anatomy of an Artist.
Oh.
And I'm just interviewing people who are making their living with their art,
mm-hmm.
people that I have reason to admire when I can talk to them, and I have tremendous admiration for you.
No, thank you.
You are welcome. So it's really just whatever you would want to say about how you found this, some stuff about yourself. You know, this is radio, so people aren't looking at you.
Right. Well, I can remember as about 3 years old, starting to listen to, we had, you might remember these TV consoles that had, it was a large cabinet, and it had a black and white TV in it, and it also had a turntable with an AM/FM radio built in.
I do remember.
You remember those?
I
well,
do.
Now I'm dating myself.
And me.
and my folks had one of those, and I used to love listening to the radio, and they also had 78 RPM records,
mm-hmm.
and you probably remember those, but
I
not
do.
People 20 born in the 80s or in the 70s wouldn't remember those at all.
No, Chances you remember are. The 33 and
oh, of course. I have boxes of them. But back when I was about 3 years old, I used to spend a lot of time listening to the radio or listening to Ken Griffin organ records. Do you remember Ken Griffin?
I do not.
He was one of the first to popularize the Wurlitzer electric organ as an instrument to record on.
Mm.
And his style was, it was very simple, very basic, sometimes three-note chords in the left hand, and he'd work the bass pedals, the foot pedals on the organ, you know, and he plays these simple chords in the left hand and just basically melody and bass, sometimes harmonize the melody a little bit in the right hand. And it was very straightforward. Very simple style, but if you can imagine a three-year-old child, my hands weren't very big,
mm-hmm.
and I had all I could do to try to figure out how to do that.
Are you serious?
I started playing when I was about 3 years old.
On a piano?
On a toy piano.
A toy, well.
I had a piano that was about knee-high. It was one of those little wooden...
Rinky-tink
pianos that sounds more like a xylophone than a piano.
I remember that.
Yeah, and then I had then I graduated to a little pump organ that was about the same size.
Now, you were trying to duplicate this organ?
I was trying to just duplicate what I heard, the melodies and the simple chords.
Yeah, this is literally playing by ear.
Playing, well, learning by ear.
Learning, and, right.
I often, when people ask me if I play by ear, I say, well, no, actually, I use my fingers. But, which, of course, I every time I think about playing by ear, I have this image that comes into my mind of my earlobe getting caught between the keys.
Yeah, right.
You know, not too comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But I learn by ear. I still do
mm-hmm.
now. I learn off of recordings, or if I'm working with musicians that want to play a song often enough, and I work with them often enough, I learn it,
mm-hmm.
you know, just by hearing the chord changes and hearing what the melody's doing.
Now, do you know what you're playing? You know you're playing a C chord, you know you're playing an A minor?
Yes.
You
yes.
do. So they could also call
They could tell
to
me
you.
About the chord changes, yeah, but then I would have to be able to hear where they're falling, you know.
You mean the voicing?
No, the placement. Because if you say, well, play A minor 7, how long do you want me to play A minor 7?
Yeah, right.
That's what I mean by where they're falling, how many measures.
I got it.
Or whether it's a half measure or, you know.
So, but if they called the chords to you as they were changing or right before they were changing.
Well, I wouldn't even have to. I could hear
that. You could hear that.
Yeah.
That's what I figured.
Yeah,
right.
I could hear that. As long as the chords aren't ridiculously complex.
Right.
Once you start adding all kinds of jazz tensions into the chords, and if they're moving in a strange way, then maybe I won't hear it quite so well.
Right, or quite so quickly.
Or quite so quickly.
Mm-hmm.
The more complex tunes are harder to learn and take more time to learn. In my teaching, I often tell my students, you know, some tunes, when you listen to a tune, you it catches you right away, and you see the melody catches you, you know, attracts your attention. You say, oh, I like this melody, this tune is just so nice.
Right.
So you gravitate toward that, and you learn the melody. So then you've got that much of it learned. Then you tackle the chord changes. Do you learn the chord changes? Then that's done. Then you put it together, and maybe it works. So other times, though, in my experience and also in the experiences of some of my students, you run across a tune that's just plain hard, period.
Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is hard. The melody's abstract and you know, obtuse and angular and weird, you know, compared to some of the more well-known tunes. And the chord changes are also weird. A tune like Lush Life, which goes all over the place, which I love the tune, but it took me about 3 months to learn it.
Wow.
Because it goes so many different keys and moves around a lot.
But once you've learned a really complicated tune, then your repertoire is expanded. Your repertoire
of
what you can conceive of.
Yeah, yes, it helps in that respect. But it also gives you another great tune to play. So, you know, the more of those you have, the better off.
Yes, it does.
But getting back to, we're kind of going in roundabouts here. But so I started out on those toy keyboards.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, I would try to play whatever caught my attention. Try to work on it and learn to play it.
What did your family think of this?
They encouraged it to a point, although both of my parents were working people.
Mm-hmm. Not musicians.
We lived in a mill town up in New Hampshire, Nashua, New Hampshire, which used to be a mill town with a lot of my dad worked, for example, worked in a tannery for 20 years.
Mm.
And he did all kinds of other jobs, too. And both my parents worked until very late in life.
Yeah.
They didn't have the kinds of resources, the kinds of money to go out and buy me a grand piano.
Right.
They couldn't. That was out of the question.
But they bought you something to play with.
Toy pianos, toy accordions, mm-hmm. toy pump organ. And then when I was about 6 years old and I was getting ready to attend the Perkins School for the Blind, a neighbor of ours had an old upright, which they weren't using, and they gave it to us.
Oh.
So that I was thrilled. It wasn't a great instrument, but all the keys worked.
Mm-hmm.
And it, curiously enough, now that I think back on it, though, it was one of those old, big, tall uprights that you see in a lot of the, if you've seen pictures or been to a lot of the older clubs in New York, the older, smaller jazz clubs, a lot of them had those big old uprights,
mm-hmm.
like the ones that Art Tatum would play.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're as tall as I am when I'm standing up,
mm-hmm.
you know. And it all worked, but curiously enough, it couldn't be brought up to pitch because it was so old.
Oh.
So it was a half tone flat, which meant that for me to play in the key of C, so it would sound like the key of C, I had to play in D flat. So I had that challenge to deal with all the time, too. And so once then, I attended the Perkins School for the Blind in Watertown, Mass., which is a suburb of Boston.
Mm-hmm.
And in the fourth grade, the way things worked at Perkins when I went there, everybody took piano lessons starting in the fourth grade. Everybody took part in the chorus, whether you could sing or not, or whether you could play or not, you took lessons or you took part in the chorus.
Wow.
That's just the way it was. Those things weren't up for negotiation.
Wow. Do you have an idea why?
Well, it was a private school. They could make their own regulations.
Yeah, absolutely.
For one
thing.
Right.
They could do what they wanted.
And I'm very thankful that I got that early exposure to music. In the third grade, I started learning how to read Braille music.
Mm.
Which I don't use anymore. I learn everything by ear, as I said, now, because it's just more immediate. And the Braille music, a lot of the things, that the tunes that I would be interested in learning aren't available in Braille music anyway. That's not a viable option. So at Perkins, I had 4 years of piano lessons. And
well, you must have been ahead of the game.
In some respects, but when I left Perkins after the eighth grade, I went to Bishop Girton High School in my hometown,
mm-hmm.
which is a college prep Catholic high school that's run by the Brothers of the Sacred Heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out how far behind the eight ball I was once I started attending a college prep high school, when my assignments would carry me from the time I get home until 11 o'clock at night with a break for supper. just okay, to get my homework.
Okay, we're talking about academics.
Academics, yes.
Yeah.
I was way behind.
Yeah, I was. When I said you were ahead, I meant...
Musically, yeah. I had a rudimentary knowledge of some things like intervals and chords. Although I didn't often know the names of them, I knew what majors and minors sounded like.
Mm-hmm.
But
oh my gosh! So your high school must have been a lot of work.
It was 4 years of hard work,
mm-hmm.
just to keep up. And my mother went back to school practically. You know, she kept her job, but after she got home from work, guess what she did? Cracked the books and tried to help me with my homework. And
so did you have Braille?
I had some Braille, and I had some books recorded on reel-to-reel tape.
Oh my goodness.
So I learned, I that was when I really started getting into working with alternative, because one thing we haven't mentioned here, although people who know me and have seen me in Sarasota or Cape Cod or wherever I've played know that I am totally blind.
Yeah.
And I'm not at all uncomfortable about talking about that, because that's just reality for me.
No, it's
always been
life.
That way. It
right.
is a fact of life.
Yeah. I didn't say it because I thought it was yours to say.
Well, as you can see, I don't have a problem talking about it. It has posed some interesting challenges for sure. But there, fortunately, even back when I was in high school, people thought of the idea of recording books on tape.
Mm-hmm.
So I got used to the books that weren't available in Braille, and many of them weren't,
mm-hmm.
and couldn't be prepared in time for the next year or whenever they were needed. My vocational rehab counselors up in the state of New Hampshire, you know, put together a list of people to record books on tape for me.
Oh.
So that's how I got through high school, and that's largely how I got through college. Let me get back to high school now. Bishop Girton High School, my junior year, I can remember this as, I don't remember exactly what date this happened, but I got a call to play my first gig.
Oh, my God.
My junior year in high school, I got a call from the brother of a classmate of mine who played trumpet in a small combo in town. And he called, and this was a Saturday afternoon, and he called and he said, Mike, I know you play the piano because my brother tells me all about you, and I've heard you play. Our regular piano player got sick tonight. Could you play a gig tonight? I didn't even know what a gig was. I said, well, what's that? What is it? You know, what do you mean? I said, well, we got this party, this bowling banquet that we've been hired to play, and, you know, could you? So he read off a list of a bunch of songs that they usually played, and I said, well, I know all of these well enough to get through them. That won't be the same as your regular piano player, but I'll do the best I can.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first music gig.
Oh,
that was my first
God.
Paying gig.
So how was it?
It was a ball. And we got fed, too. And I got home. I'll never forget it. I got home with a bill of paper currency in my pocket. It was a cash payment. And it was $10. And that was big money.
I know.
Back in 1967 for a high school kid to go out and play music. I was thrilled.
You know, I want to stop you for a second because I want to say, of course, this is radio, so you can't see, but Mike is as delighted now, I think, almost as he must have been at the time.
Oh, it's part
of his charm, is how immediate his pleasure is, and you hear it when he's playing. You hear this delight that's coming through him, you know, into the keys. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to stop you.
No, I'm glad. No, it's, one thing I tell a lot of my, I tell all my students this at one time or another, and I teach private students here, and I also teach, I'm the adjunct instructor of jazz piano at Manatee Community College, and my college students come here for lessons also, because I'm set up to record and all that, you know. And as you saw when you came in the music room, I have a Mason and Hamlin Grand, and I have a Yamaha Electronic set up, too. So if we need to play on two pianos, we can do it.
Mm-hmm.
It works very well, for the most part. But one thing I tell all my students, at one time or another, or many times if need be, is that playing music has to be fun first. If it's fun first, everything else will take care of itself in due time.
Yes, I believe it. And
it really works.
You know, and you practice what you preach. You live what you say. It's so clear.
Oh, well, thank you.
Oh, Mike, my God. Okay, so you got that gig. And
so I got that gig, and then, I really got a kick out of that.
I'll bet.
We had a great meal. We had a lot of, you know, fun hanging out on the breaks, and I got through all the tunes alive, no major disasters.
And you thought, this is not a bad thing.
This is pretty good. I'm, you you know, I could do this sometimes, you know. Then
Up until then, had you thought what you might do?
I actually originally, when I was in high school, I was one of my strong subjects in high school was French.
Oh.
And I was thinking about majoring in French in college and minoring in government with the idea of being a translator or an interpreter for either the U.S. government or the U.N. or the diplomatic service or something.
Right.
But all that changed my freshman year in college. When I was a freshman at Dartmouth College back in 1967-68, a guy that lived in the room next door to me in the dorm I lived in played Oscar Peterson's Night Train album for me one night, and I just flipped out. I said, oh my God, this is what I've been looking for a long time. And I made up my mind at that point I was at least going to explore the possibility of majoring in music.
Oh my.
So I got into jazz piano rather late in the game compared to a lot of people.
Yes, you did.
If you stop and think about it.
And so, now again, your parents are paying for you to go to, you know.
Well, I got they helped. But fortunately, because I had gotten straight A's in high school, through all that hard work, which I alluded to a while ago, I still remember it as clear as day, how long those days were, and but I don't regret doing it for a minute. It's just, but it was, it wasn't the kind of life that a normal high school student lives, nowhere near. I had to work real hard to get those grades. But I knew darn well that I wanted to go to a good college when I got out of high school, not just any college.
Right.
And I ended up going to Dartmouth College.
A good college.
Very good college. And I got a scholarship because my grades and my achievement test scores were so good.
Yeah. What I was going to ask was, when your parents heard that you were...
They were in a little bit in a state of shock.
I'll bet they were.
They...
Here they had a translator and a diplomatic corps, and now they've got...
I was going to try to learn how to interpret music.
Yeah, right.
Rather than a spoken language, I was going to try to learn how to interpret the music language in a way that worked for me.
Yeah, it's very similar, but I'm sure to your parents it's...
But their first one of their first reactions was, how do you think you're going to make
a living
doing this? Do you realize how unstable this profession is?
Right.
They had been around long enough to know.
Right.
And, my answer to them was, well, you know, if I don't at least explore it, I will kick myself for the rest of my life for not having done it.
And they understood that.
They understood that.
Good for them.
And I made an appointment during my freshman year with the chairman of the music department, who has since passed away. But he was an organist, and he taught music theory. And he heard me practicing on one of the Steinway pianos that was readily available in the student lounge. And he was very open and honest about it. He said, I'll tell you what, he said, the music major here at Dartmouth is not really performance-oriented at this point.
Mm-hmm.
It's a liberal arts, music theory, music history kind of major, mostly.
Mm-hmm.
If you can take lessons, but at this point, the way it's set up, we don't give academic credit for the lessons, even though you have to pay for them.
Mm-hmm.
But you can study privately if that's what you want to do, and it will cost you, whatever it was. And then he said, well, I have to tell you something else. He said, we have never had a blind music major here.
Wow.
So that's going to be different for us. It's going to be a challenge. But he was very willing to at least explore the possibility.
Mm-hmm.
So in the fall of 1968, I took my first college-level music course, which was elementary harmony, with the Glee Club director, who also taught theory and whatever, counterpoint and various courses. And he was one of the key people in really helping me absorb the language and learn it a lot faster, because a couple of weeks into the class, after class, he said, Mike, do you have a few minutes? I said, yeah, I have a couple of minutes before I have to go. Well, what do you have in mind? He said, well, how do you think you're grasping the material? Do you think you're understanding the terminology? And I said, well, as doing as well as I can, I'm taking notes. And
it's really hard.
Well, it can be, but he said, how would you feel about this? He said, I have in mind one of our best students who's already had this course. He's a very advanced student. He knows his stuff. how would you feel if he tutored you and recorded keyboard examples for you and did whatever along that to help you learn them? I said, wow. This teacher really took an interest in me.
He didn't
have to do it.
I have tears in my eyes.
He didn't have to do it.
That's right.
And I was almost speechless. You know?
I'm sure, because I'm crying.
His name was Paul Zeller, and I said, Paul, I really appreciate this. This is the first time that a professor has taken this much interest, and it means a lot to me, and I will do everything I can to learn this as well as I can, you know?
Yes.
When I took the exam, I got my first B at Dartmouth College in elementary harmony. So, and that whole year, my sophomore year, I really prayed hard and thought hard about what it was going to mean to try to embark on a music career. Mm-hmm. And as sure as I'm sitting here, one night I was debating what to do, tossing it and turning it around, you know, in my mind. And as sure as I'm sitting here, I heard this voice. Michael, I know you're way behind the eight ball compared to people who have played piano seriously for 10 or 12 years and had studied a lot of theory and all that, but you have the means to do this, and I will see to it that you are able to do it if you just plunge into it.
Oh, Michael.
So I said, okay, there's my answer. That's all I need to know.
Oh.
I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it the best shot I have, and wherever it leads me, at least I will have been able to say I gave it the best shot I could.
Right.
So I ended up graduating in 1971 from Dartmouth College with distinction in music major. Got a real good music history and music theory background, mostly. But my junior and senior years, I got a chance to study with some jazz musicians who were artists in residence at the time, which was just great. I got a chance to study with Dwight Mitchell, mm-hmm. the pianist. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know him.
I don't know him.
Wonderful pianist. Mm-hmm. And his bassist, Willie Ruff, taught him a jazz history class. Mm-hmm. My senior year at Dartmouth, that was. And then in my junior year, I studied with Don Cherry, the cornetist.
Yeah,
the jazz
he is.
What a character. But I learned a lot from him. You know, his approach was more into the free jazz and just somebody start something and the rest of you jump in and put something together from that. You know, it was a lot in that vein.
Mm-hmm.
So I got some exposure to that. And then after Dartmouth, I lived at home with my parents for a while and went back to went to a small college in Nashua called Riviere College, and I studied more classical piano and form and analysis, you know, more music theory.
Wow.
Then I went very briefly to the Berklee College of Music, one day a week for one semester, and I studied jazz, piano, and improv there.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz, piano and jazz theory there, and then my next major move was the University of New Hampshire in 1974.
My goodness, this is years and years and
years. Yeah, yep, and during my studies at UNH, I studied classical piano and played jazz gigs on the side when I could, and I did that as much as I could, and got a chance to study jazz piano with one instructor toward the end, but then in 1978, I graduated with my master's in music, my MA in music from the University of New Hampshire.
We're looking at 10 years from now, right?
Yep. But, and if you count the time I started playing when I was 3 years old, you figure that in, you're talking almost 30 years.
Yeah, now. Right.
And then in 1978, I moved to Cape Cod, and that's where I spent the first 10 years of my full-time career.
Mm-hmm. What made you go there?
Well, it's an interesting story. I was playing a wedding reception somewhere, and one of the people that was there ran a restaurant in Falmouth, Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Liked my playing and invited me to move down to the Cape once I finished my degree.
Oh.
And play a five-night-a-week position down
there. Well, so you graduated right into work.
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. In June of 78, I started my Cape Cod career. Played at Molly's Restaurant in Falmouth, and then the Kuna Messed Inn, and the places, the Bobby Burns Hyannis Pub, and the Asa Bears House in Hyannis, the Paddock Restaurant, Dunphy Hotel.
You must have thought you were going to stay there.
I thought for a while. I thought it was going to be a place for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, 10 years is a fairly long time.
Yeah, it is.
But in about the mid-80s, the economy up there really started taking a hit.
Yes,
and it was hard to even get a gig playing solo piano anywhere, let alone with a combo.
Wow.
That pretty much dried up a lot. Mm-hmm. So, and again, another interesting thing happened. Two friends of mine who listened to me a lot on the Cape had a winter place down here in Bradenton. In 1988, they invited me down here to visit, and they, well, before I came down, they did some sleuthing around to see what the music opportunities might be like here, and as it turned out, there was a place on Main Street which was looking for a, in Sarasota, which was looking for a pianist to play five nights a week.
What?
Horse Feathers.
Oh,
it's
my God.
No longer here.
I know. It's that other thing on the corner, right?
It was a great place.
Yeah.
And they had... So anyway, so I came down here and visited my friends, the Chandlers, and for about 10 days, and I auditioned at Horse Feathers, and I got the job. Mm-hmm. So, and within about a month after that, I sort of packed things up, and with the help of my dad, we moved me down here to Sarasota, and I got oriented. He stayed for about a week or a week and a half to help me get situated, learn my way around downtown enough so I could get around on my own, which there's another challenge of being a totally blind person in a sighted world.
Unbelievable.
And by the time he left, I knew where, you know, a few restaurants were in the bank that I was going to go to for do my banking in the post office.
Where
were
you
going to
live?
While I was living, at the time I was living in an apartment on South Osprey Avenue.
So you were close to downtown? So you
Very
could walk?
Close. I could walk everywhere.
Yeah.
Which was wonderful.
It's wonderful.
Yeah. It really is wonderful. And I got hooked on the weather down here very quickly. I came down here in November of 88, and I said, oh, man, it's in the 70s, it's in the 80s. I can wear shorts like I am right now.
Yeah.
And I said, I like this.
Yeah. Just coming from...
from Cape Cod. Yeah. Though New England winters can be pretty hellacious.
Yes.
So I started playing in Horse Feathers, and 2 months later... due to lack of business, it closed.
Yeah.
And here I was. I just moved down here. Oh, man. One gig ended. Well, again, I had sat in a few times at the Gator Club while I was playing in Horse Feathers. Once I got done, I went over to the Gator Club and sat in a few times. And they had a jazz policy there, six nights a week then.
Oh, yeah.
When Jay Foley ran it.
Yeah.
And the bass player that was playing in a combo then was Ernie Williford, who I still work with every chance I can.
Mm-hmm.
He's been not only a fun person to play with, but he's been a friend and very helpful to, you know, when that's been needed.
Mm-hmm.
He's a great guy, and he's a lot of fun to work with. And well, he was in this combo at the Gator Club at the time, and the manager at the Gator Club knew what was about to happen at Horse Feathers, because he said to me, well, if something happens at Horse Feathers, and I could... It's a small town, you know. A lot people know what's going on.
Yes, they do.
Especially if they're in the same industry.
Oh, yeah.
They're
all watching.
Sure. And so he said, if something happens at Horse Feathers, you've got a job here, because I've been thinking we've needed to do something with the trio here.
Uh-huh.
So Horse Feathers closed on a Saturday night. I went over to the Gator Club, and the manager was true to his word. He said, I'll tell you what, we have jazz here Monday through Saturday. How about you start Monday night? So I didn't even miss a night's work.
Oh, my God.
So
it does seem like you've been...
Just been in the right place at the right time. And, you know, there's no way of knowing that.
Well, but you trusted that it would be, didn't you?
Well, it was a little scary for a while. I mean, when those things happen, it is a little... So it can be a little unsettling.
No kidding.
But ultimately, usually when one door closes, another one opens sooner or later.
Mm-hmm.
And... Ernie and I and various drummers, mostly Louis Firkovich, played at the Gator Club for 17 months, six nights a week. Then we played over Coasters at Coasters on Siesta Key for 11 months.
Mm-hmm.
And I played at Michael's on East for about 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
And now I'm at Caragiulo's Thursdays and Fridays and at Euphemia on Sunday nights.
Uh-huh.
So those are my steady jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Now, besides that, I play a lot of assisted living facilities at various times, various days, on a varying schedule.
Yeah.
Depending on what they want, how they want me to fit in, and I'm always looking for concerts and, you know, that kind of work.
And you
parties.
Teach.
And I teach. Mm-hmm. And I've done recording, too.
Yes.
So, it's a busy life. It's a very busy life, but it's been very rewarding. Challenging, yes. Scary at times, yes.
Yes.
But I don't regret deciding to do it at all.
No.
I really don't regret it.
And I want to say again that something that you clearly never lost was this, I don't know, optimism, positiveness.
Well, pessimism gets you nowhere but in worse trouble.
Yeah.
It really does.
No, I agree.
And it saps your energy, something wicked.
Mm-hmm.
And the last thing you need if you're going to be doing something creative is to lose your energy.
No, that's
because that's where it comes from, is the universal manager. That's where it comes from. You know, whatever you want, choose to call God,
higher power, the force,
or the higher intelligence, or
yes, right.
You know, everybody has different ideas about what they want to call that, or whether they believe in that or not. I definitely believe in it.
No, well, you heard from it, didn't you?
More than once. More than once.
Uh-huh.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
For sure.
You know, one night you sat in at Baco's.
Yes.
Oh, my God. Oh. And you did that thing that I imagine you do a lot where, you know, one song to another, and culling this and reaching out. What do they call that when you
throw in quotes from...
Yeah, quoting, right.
Well, quoting is one word for it.
Right.
And the a jazz term that they use for that, at least when I was studying jazz history back in my college years, is interpolation.
Interpolation.
Yes.
Yes.
It means placing... juxtaposing something from another piece of music in the piece you're playing.
Yes,
what it means. And it could be a short quote,
yeah,
little short excerpt, or it could be more than a short excerpt.
Yeah, and that night, you did a great deal of that.
I do.
Oh, you do, and it was, I mean, you can hear the audience just erupts over, you know, because they recognize it, you know, they know you've gone someplace else.
How do you fit that in?
Yeah, right, and they're so delighted. It's so...
Well, the thought process that as nearly as I can figure out how that works for me anyway is that I'm constantly, when I'm playing, I'm listening to the chord changes a lot,
mm-hmm.
you know, and I'm trying to think of something that will fit,
mm-hmm.
even if it fits loosely, even if there's some jagged notes, some off color notes. If it doesn't fit, I'll bend it.
You will.
Yeah. You know.
So, well, you know what they say about jazz, that if you hit a wrong note...
Keep playing it. It's going to sound right.
That's right.
Yeah. There are really no wrong notes. There are all kinds of choices,
that's
though.
Right.
And that's the beauty of jazz, is that it really is... as many times as I've played a lot of the standards, I've never stopped falling in love with the standards.
Mm-hmm.
I really think, I'm convinced in my teaching experience also, that one thing that if you're going to try to show somebody jazz piano, you should show them how to play the blues, and you should try to show them how to play standards first, mm-hmm. before they go any other direction.
Well, I'm delighted to hear it, because of course as a singer, the standards are...
They're class. They're timeless.
They're timeless.
Absolutely timeless.
That's right. It's odd. I was having this conversation with Charlie Prodzik.
Uh-huh. You know Charlie? Yeah, I know Charlie.
Yeah,
sure.
I'm sure you did.
I know him, and I think he's a wonderful player.
He's a wonderful player.
Mm-hmm.
He's a wonderful player, and he's a wonderful accompanist.
Yes, he is. Yeah. And I enjoy that, too, when I get the chance to do it.
Yeah. I've never sung with you, so
no.
I don't want to speak to that.
No, but we'll have to do that sometime.
I certainly hope so.
I'd like to.
Yes, so would I. And Charlie and I were talking about the standards, and I was saying, so my listeners are going to hear this again twice now, that a lot of pop and rock singers, as soon as they possibly can, they make albums of standards.
Rod Stewart. There's one example.
Oh, yeah.
Linda Ronstadt.
And these are exactly the examples that I gave.
Sure.
Know? Right. And so it's like, you know, these songs, musicians love them.
And there are good reasons for it. I mean, you know, when you think about the repertoire of people like Cole Porter and mm-hmm. Gershwin,
right.
and Rodgers and Hart and Jerome Kern and Dietz and Schwartz and
Frank Lesser, and, Rodgers and Hart.
Yeah,
did you say that?
Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Rodgers
even
and
the
Hammerstein.
Show tunes. A lot
right.
of the show tunes are wonderful jazz vehicles.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and it's because the melodies make sense.
Yes.
The average listener can grasp what the melody is. Can also grasp what the basic harmony is, as long as it's reasonably played.
Mm-hmm.
And you can go from there.
But it's interesting.
There.
The harmonies are interesting.
They are.
They're not complicated. You know, they're not difficult, but they're interesting.
They're interesting enough.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have some jazz techniques under your fingers and some jazz theory, you can plug in some substitute chords, which can make it even more interesting.
More interesting, I agree.
The stuff is so timeless that it's as timeless as Bach or Beethoven or Chopin, you know, but it's a different idiom, that's all.
Right. Well, and then, of course, the lyrics.
The lyrics, yes.
They are lyrics.
wonderful lyrics. And you can actually understand what they mean.
Right, exactly. That's exactly right. And they're interesting. You know, interesting.
Yes, absolutely.
So, and again, as a singer, you know, the lyrics are so important to me. So.
Yes.
Well,
sure.
Yeah.
They are.
Well, Mike, this is so lovely. This is also incredibly interesting to me. So I always like to, at the, you know, as we're sort of ending, to ask whoever I'm interviewing if there's anything that I forgot to ask or that you would like to talk about or that you have to say about life in music or almost anything that on your mind.
It's just, I guess, I am always, I can honestly say that one of the things that I enjoy most is playing concerts, either solo or with combos or in any number of configurations.
And why?
Well, lounge work is one thing, and it serves a very valuable purpose, okay? And,
yeah, but people don't really listen.
Well, some do. I mean, you get some that do and some that don't.
Mm-hmm.
But when you're playing a concert, they are there for one reason. They are there to hear you do what you do.
That's right.
And that is the ultimate satisfaction.
Yes.
For me as a performer, if I can play a concert.
Yeah.
I love playing concerts in churches or concert halls or whatever, wherever I can, you know, that's suitable.
Well, okay. So if you're listening and you have a concert venue, Mike is available.
For the right price. assuming that it fits into the calendar and all that stuff.
Right. That's great.
But I do like that, and I enjoy, you know, working with, as I say, other musicians and solo and the whole small combo thing mostly. That's what I've done, is smaller combos.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all fun. It's all fun.
It's all fun.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, I mean, I think I've said this now a number of different times in different ways. That is the thing that comes across so strongly when you play. It's not only the virtuosity of what you're doing, which is staggering, but it's that it's fun. And it's so it makes it so delightful to listen to.
Well, you know, Oscar Peterson had a lot to do with it. in my Cape Cod years, I had the privilege many times of listening to Dave McKenna, who I think is really also one of the top players in that genre of jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And then I got a chance to study with Dr. Billy Taylor for a couple of weeks in 92, and he gave me enough stuff to work on to last me two lifetimes.
I know.
But he's just, he's a wonderful player, too, and a wonderful educator.
He's a wonderful man.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the late 60s, I was working in the Bronx, and he had this traveling...
Yes, the jazz carry van, the jazz
I forgot mobile. What it's called, the jazzmobile, right?
Jazzmobile, yes.
Right.
Yes.
Well, I was in the Bronx then when he was doing that.
Oh, God, it must have been wonderful.
Oh, it was wonderful.
Oh, what a great player.
And really, I mean, what are we talking about now? That was late 60s.
60s. And
right. You
know. He was, Debbie and I went to hear Billy Taylor at Van Wezel a few years back. That night, he played The Man I Love. And we were both sitting there, and Debbie said very quietly to me at the beginning as he was playing, the first time through the song, she said to me very quietly, "He's doing all that with his left hand." Oh my God.
Oh my God.
I mean, he was all over it. He was playing the melody and the chords, all with his left hand and moving around.
Oh my God.
With his left hand alone.
Oh my God.
And my jaw dropped. I couldn't believe it because it sounded so complete.
Yes.
And so rich and full and interesting. Mm-hmm. Of course, then after that, he went to playing it the more conventional way.
Right.
But those are things that I like, that I get ideas from when I hear people do things like that.
No kidding.
I like to try to do that once in a while. I don't know whether I'm quite up to his, but he's got a few years' experience on me too.
Yeah, and he started.
And he started with jazz very young.
Yes, but it occurs to me that you're still doing what you did with Owen, the organ player. You're listening to stuff and saying, "Yeah, let me see if I can do that."
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, it's always a work in progress anyway. Right. You know, because jazz is pure jazz. Better have some improvisation in it.
Yes.
Otherwise, it ain't
it
jazz.
It ain't jazz.
No,
right?
No, it ain't jazz. It's something else.
Yes.
It's jazzy. It's jazz-like. It sounds like jazz, but it ain't jazz. So I'm always trying to take some chances, and sometimes the things are going to work exactly as I envisioned them or as I heard them. Sometimes they might not.
Yes.
Quite work exactly as I planned, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. It's not quite the right word, but exactly as I envisioned it or heard it in my inner ear, you know.
You know, sometimes
because you're dealing with fractions of inches here, sometimes in making those moves on the piano keyboard or a jump.
Yeah.
You're dealing. If you're a fraction of an inch off,
you're off.
You're off. So just keep playing that note. So it's gonna fit.
Sometimes when I'm singing, I'll get this idea of someplace I want to go, and I'll go there, and then I won't be able to find my way back.
Oh, God. This reminds me of a funny, funny true story that happened a while back.
Mm-hmm.
I was booked to play a concert at the Sarasota Bay Club with Ernie Williford on bass and Johnny Moore on drums.
Mm-hmm.
You know the two of them?
Oh, yes.
Wonderful guys.
Mm-hmm.
Well, here I am. A lot of these people are, you know, 70s and up.
Right.
I started playing There Is No Greater Love, and it was so outside, and I couldn't get back in. The whole concert was like that. The scat singing, everything. Went all the way out there. And I knew I should have been reining it back in, but I couldn't do it, because that thing just got me, and that was it. It was outside, and it stayed outside.
But, you know, I mean, you could probably get away with it.
I got away with it, I think. They did hire us back later on, so I guess I didn't really burn any bridges, although Ernie told me a couple of people were giving me a look like, what? Do you know what you're doing?
Playing?
Yeah. What in the world are you playing anyway? Even though I made a point to announce the songs before I played them.
That doesn't mean they knew it.
No.
This is so wonderful for me because I think I'm the only person who does that, you know, that I get this idea and I get lost.
I get lost too. I get lost, but sooner or later, you know, something clicks.
Mm-hmm.
Something clicks, and you get back there eventually. When we played at the Gator Club, I can remember I used to, you know, start doing my quoting, you know, and Louie, the drummer, he'd get all in a tizzy because he'd forget what song we were playing, and Ernie would just say to him, "Just play time, man. Just keep the time going. Don't listen to him. Don't listen to him."
I could not agree more. And it seems to me that that's the perfect place to stop this. Mike, this has been so wonderful.
Oh, it's been
wonderful.
Fun for me, too.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
So, if it's not fun, why do it? Of course, only a person who is really doing what they are meant to do, completely and wholly themselves, can say, if it isn't fun, why do it? And I do these interviews so that you can hear what it sounds like when your life reflects who you are. And it is my hope that when you listen to someone like Mike, you ask yourself, am I doing what is fun? And if not, why am I doing it? And if the answer is because I can't locate, or I could locate, but I don't feel safe demonstrating who I really am, who I would be if I was doing the thing that was just fun. Well, it's my intention with this show to say it may not be too late. If you want to talk to me about that, get me to speak to your group or organization, get my book, which is called When You Can, You Will, on my website, thelynshow.com. That's thelynneshow. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. thelynshow.com. And up there, you can also listen to all the interviews I've done, including this one. So, as always, I hope you got something you can use from this show. Something that intrigued or inspired you, or just something that made you have as much fun as Mike and I were having. And so, as always, I hope you heard something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station. And as always, I sure hope you will be too. So as promised, we're going to go out on another cut from Mike's CD, Solid. The first cut was sweet and romantic and sensitive, and this one swings. So here is Mike Markovarich and his trio.
I'm getting older, my hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring, I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. Singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly, well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper, I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, it. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight, no, no. We will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang.